Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining our last webinar for the 2019-2020 Scholar in Resident application cycle. We've been looking over some of the draft proposals and the proposal narratives and the institutional profiles as they've come in the last couple of days and over the last week, and we're getting really excited seeing all of these different proposals and ideas for scholars visiting campuses, and I hope you are as well. The goal of this session is to provide some of that last-minute feedback and answers as you begin your MBARC applications, or if you have any technical questions about submitting your proposals and your narratives. So my name is Tim Nicholson. I'm a Global Portfolio Officer here at IIE. I'm also joined by Derek Cook and David Levin from the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs. Do you both want to introduce yourselves?
Sure, yeah, this is Derek. I've worked here at IIE for 7 years on various aspects of the Fulbright program and predominantly interact with our U.S. higher education community on some of our professional development programs, which includes FLTA, which is the Foreign Language Teaching Assistant program, and now Scholar in Residence program.
David, do you want to introduce
David? Sure. This is David Levin with the Department of State, the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs. We're the sponsor of the Fulbright program and have the pleasure of working with IIE sort of hand-in-hand with all of our Fulbright programs. I've been involved with Fulbright for about 35 years, in fact, and have worked with Scholar in Residence for more than 25 years. So it's clearly one of our best programs, and I admit to being biased and think that it's great.
Awesome. Thank you, David. So for today's presentation, we're going to do a brief overview of the Scholar in Residence program. I realize that most attendees on this webinar have a pretty good knowledge of the goals of the program, but just in case there are any new attendees or those who are less familiar, we want to make sure that basis is covered. And then we'll move into the Scholar in Residence application system. We've created an application and that we can all walk through and see if there are any questions, just so you see what it looks like from the applicant side if you haven't started. And throughout the presentation, if you have any questions that you'd like to ask, please type them into the chat box. We have a couple that have already been submitted, and they will work in tandem with our presentation, but we just want to make sure that, as this is the last webinar, all questions are answered by the end of this session. So without further ado, Derek, do you want to?
Yeah, sure. So I'll give a quick overview of the program, talk a little bit about what is the Scholar in Residence program. So this component of Fulbright is really meant as an opportunity for institutions that may not otherwise have the opportunity to host foreign scholars or that might not have a strong international component to their curriculum or on campus to host scholars and faculty members from overseas. So these scholars generally are teaching primarily undergraduate academic courses, and this program is very flexible, and whether that is for hosting a scholar for a single semester or for a full academic year to engage in teaching and other campus and community activities. So the SIRs are meant to help internationalize campuses and curriculums while they're on campus. So oftentimes this can mean that they work in tandem with individuals in the department or on campus to develop exchange opportunities in the future, in addition to adding that global perspective or international perspective to the curriculum and engaging with your campus community more broadly in things like presentations on campus or working with community organizations so that there's a broad-based impact to really internationalize campuses and provide international opportunities to campuses and communities that are underserved. Other outcomes have been, you know, virtual exchanges, online courses, even, you know, MOU development between a scholar's home university and the institution that is hosting an SIR. Further research collaboration with faculty members is also oftentimes a benefit of hosting a scholar. Scholars are intended to provide that cross-cultural international perspective for, again, the whole campus and also the greater community. There are about 900 Fulbright visiting scholars, if you look at the visiting scholar program as a whole, on campuses in the U.S. every year. But what sets this particular component of the program apart other than that the institutions drive the process, is that the scholars are really meant to be highly integrated into the campus and community life beyond just the courses they're teaching. So the scholars can teach a course load, but they should also be engaging with the campus, community, and culture. Oftentimes, these scholars are kind of the all-stars who can be more visible than other visiting scholars on campus who are often, you know, very much focused on their research and are less exposed to the campus community. Just a clarifying point, if there are any foreign scholars who are listening in, this application for the program is really meant to be made by U.S. institutions. So if you're a scholar who's listening, you need to identify a potential host, discuss motivations and goals with the host university, and then the institution would need to work across, you know, various units on campus to really build the support to host the scholar in residence in a way that would allow that scholar to have the sort of broad impact, not only on a, you know, not only on teaching courses, but on the campus as a whole. So this application has been opened since March, and the deadline is fast approaching, October 15th. So please, you know, we'd encourage anyone who hasn't already started an application to do so. I know some of you on the line have been having very active conversations on campus as you get prepared to submit by the deadline. But we really, this program really does provide a wealth of resources to host someone, to have a great impact. And we also want to provide you with resources to help you submit a well-thought-out proposal. That's one of the reasons why we wanted to do this webinar. So we have our email up. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to get in touch with us. Obviously, as Tamman mentioned, we encourage you to submit questions during the webinar as well so that we can help answer those as you prepare to finalize those applications. So again, this program is really targeted at institutions that are infrequent hosts of visiting scholars or don't have necessarily the resources to provide those international perspectives to their students or to the campus community. We also welcome institutions to partner with other institutions. So if there are institutions that are more have a little bit more robust international presence on campus, it's not a bad idea to partner with a local institution such as the community college or a liberal arts institution nearby you that may not have the same resources available, and that can also be a productive way to engage with this program. I think we can maybe have David talk a little bit about the sort of program benefits, especially for some underrepresented institutions, and any other insights you might want to share about the SIR program. So David, if you want to sort of take it, feel free to.
Thanks. I'm happy to do that. So if you go online and you look at the description of the program, you see that we're, as talking about, we're reaching out to institutions that are traditionally less engaged in international and less experienced hosting Fulbright scholars or other kinds of scholars. We also talk about the fact that we're reaching out to audiences that serve minority students, minority enrollment. So when we, by virtue of doing that, you see we've actually given preference to minority-serving institutions and community colleges and rural colleges and small and large colleges. Again, institutions that are less engaged and or those that are serving minority audiences. You know, we see this as a really a tool for not only you helping you internationalize your curriculum through what your SIR would be teaching, but also think creatively about how can you use that scholar advantageously across campus. We want them to not just interact with the students that they're working with through the courses they're teaching, but other kinds of things that they might be doing across campus. Maybe they become part of the International Student Advisor. Maybe they are engaged in Faculty Senate and get a sense of that part of a campus operation. Maybe they're engaged in guest lecturing in other programs across campus and other departments. Think creatively about how to utilize that scholar. It's obviously beneficial to you, but beneficial to them too, because part of this is a learning experience for them. And I think this program works so well because typically the schools that are submitting applications, they do this via some kind of committee on campus. You get a number of thoughts together from a variety of people, thinking creatively about how to use that scholar by virtue of you designing the blueprint as to what you want that scholar to do in terms of teaching, in terms of curriculum, in terms of engagement across campus, in terms of interaction with your community beyond campus, the fact that you thought through this in advance as part of your institutional proposal really helps guarantee that it's going to be successful for everyone, and it really is sort of a win-win situation. And I think by designing that sort of campus approach and that blueprint, it also leads you to, as Derek was talking about, how can you think about the benefits of that scholar being maintained once the scholar goes home, whether it's through the virtual exchange programs and online teaching, or whether it's an MOU, or whether it's engagement between host and host camp, home and host campus, home and host community. Think creatively about how can you take advantage of this SIR once the SIR has the exchange is completed and the scholars returned home.
Thank you, David. I'm also, just to piggyback on that, I'm going to pick on your 35 years of knowledge as well to talk a little bit about the diversity statement from the Bureau of Education and Cultural Affairs as we get into the different types of institutions and student bodies and students that, that SARs might interact with.
Sure. So the Bureau of Education and Cultural Affairs, otherwise known as ECA, we administer a whole range of exchange programs, Fulbright being the centerpiece. We have 40 to 50 programs. We support 50,000 people a year going on exchange, whether it's Americans going overseas, whether it's foreign citizens coming to the United States. Whole range of programs, academic and non-academic, professional, cultural, sports, arts, ESL, foreign students, you name it. We call ourselves one-stop shopping for international exchange. And as we go about doing that, we place great emphasis on the fact that these programs need to be diverse and inclusive. You know, by and large, being paid for by U.S. taxpayers' dollars. Therefore, they need to represent really the face of America abroad and the face of other societies in the United States through the scholars and students and grantees that are coming here. Not to mention the fact that we think that these programs are strong and can be ultimately as strong as they can be when they're in fact diverse and inclusive and include people from all walks of life, whether that's race or ethnicity or gender or religion or disability or LGBT or socioeconomic status, underserved geographic areas. We define diversity broadly and really encompasses all these different kinds of aspects of diversity. We make a point about saying that our programs are open and inclusive, and you know, we've no doubt that this concept of merit-based selection, which is what all the programs are engaged with, can relate to anyone. And I think this program really epitomizes that because of the fact that we're clearly reaching out to diverse audiences, and that I think enhances the impact of the program because in many ways we're helping schools internationalize that may not have done this before or may have done some kinds of things but have said, okay, we'd like to expand our programs, take them in a new direction, and hopefully the SIR program can help us do that.
Thank you, David. That was a perfect, I think, summation of the SIR program.
And I'm going to sort of, you know, dovetail here with a lot of what David's talked about and talking about, you know, what we're looking for in a proposal to host a scholar in residence. So I know many of you have been working on proposals. Some of you have submitted proposals to get some feedback from our office about ways you could tighten your proposal and make it stronger. So I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, what is the sort of review committee looking for in a proposal to host a scholar in residence. So, you know, I think one of the key pieces is just making sure that the proposal as a whole is really working together to make clear your goals. I know a common point of feedback that I've given a few campuses is really, you know, in that institutional profile section, you know, as you're writing out, you know, who you are as an institution, what goals your institution is trying to meet, think about, even in the course of doing that, you know, how does hosting a scholar in residence through this program help meet some of those goals, help address your student demographics and, you know, ways in which those demographics may be underserved by these kinds of international global opportunities, and be as specific as possible, you know, as you think about the ways in which the scholar can benefit you. Because as David mentioned, you know, the more clear it is that you have a blueprint for how to engage this individual on campus, the clearer it is to all parties on our side, the review committee included, that this is going to be a as David put it, a win-win situation, you know, for everyone involved. That there's going to be a clear impact that the scholar has on campus, and that there's going to be a clear impact to the scholar that you're hosting, that what we hope sort of continues on in the future for both parties. And this is a really unique opportunity to think through that very carefully and strategically engage that person on campus, and really make those areas of strategic engagement as clear as possible. I mean, I think, you know, we all understand there's going to be some flexibility depending on, you know, who the scholar is, what their interests are once they get on the ground. But we want to see those ideas that you have about ways they could be engaged, you know, before, that, just seeing that you've thought through those before hosting. So, you know, that's one of the things that's really being reviewed quite carefully. You know, what are the short-term goals? What are the long-term goals of engaging with this program? Are those goals, you know, attainable? Are they sustainable? Making those sort of points clear in your proposal. And then thinking about feasibility. You know, is what you're asking the scholar to do, is it feasible within the time period that you're hosting the scholar, whether that be a single semester, whether that be a full academic year? And does that sort of line up with other elements of your proposal? I think the other piece to really think through is, you know, how is the person going to be engaged in the community? You know, we hope that in hosting a scholar in residence, you're also thinking about ways that the campus community through the scholar can engage with the larger community that you're situated in. So think about organizations in the community that the scholar can be involved with, can contribute their unique perspectives to. And again, I think be as specific as possible when you're thinking about making that request for a scholar from a particular country, from a particular region. You know, why are you asking for someone from that country, from that region? You know, what is the unique thing that scholar who's operating in that context in their home country can bring to your campus and your community? Also think about, you know, what the scholar is going to gain and make that clear. You know, is it hoped that this will dovetail with some area of their research, that they'll be able to have some collaborative research with faculty who are currently on your campus? Is there sort of sufficient professional enrichment opportunities for the scholar that you're hoping to host outlined in the proposal? I think these are some of the things that are, you know, pretty important to consider. And again, just making that proposal as cohesive as possible. You know, sometimes you see a really strong argument in a proposal in the opening about, you know, how a scholar is going to benefit an institutional type that is underserved, but then in the actual description of, say, academic activities, campus activities, that thread is not drawn through quite as explicitly, you know, about exactly what the scholar is going to bring to the coursework, you know, to the engagement in other courses where they may be guest lecturing, to, as David mentioned, you know, working with an international students or scholars office in some capacity. You know, what are they bringing to those roles and to your campus that you can't get from your current faculty, you know, and think through those things, because that makes a stronger argument for your proposal.
So with that being said,
there is a question that's come in that I think we'll take this chance to address. And this is a pretty specific one, so I'll read this and then we can sort of talk about it. It says, our proposal is for 3 months and includes a scholar teaching for the semester. However, our semester is not a typical 16 weeks. The second activity would be that the scholar partners with our faculty to design a course for online delivery. So altogether, the scholar would be involved in 3 months of activity with approximately 2 months of teaching activity. I think that's because of the way the semester calendar is. Will this be acceptable to Fulbright, or would our proposal be thrown out? I think the short answer is no. Your proposal would not be thrown out, and that this is acceptable. I think the thing we would be looking at is there a clear plan of engagement, you know, during that period where they're not teaching the course, and does that make sense in terms of what goals you have? I think, you know, we don't want someone to be unoccupied during a period, so as long as there's a really clear and strong plan for engagement during that period where they're not teaching, that this would be a totally acceptable proposal in terms of its structure. I do think there are also things to think about. I think we also don't want the scholar only teaching during that two-month period, but there should also be a plan for how this person is going to be engaged more broadly even during that period, and then filling some of that out when the coursework is no longer being taught during that month or so period, and the focus is on delivering the online course, but what else are they going to be engaged in? Is there anything that Hammond you would add, or David, you might add to that?
My addition would be similar to what you mentioned about tying it through the entire presentation. I think in the institutional profile aspect, that's when I would make the case of why this makes the most sense for your institution. It might not make sense at other institutions, but this is your demographic. This is how the scholar could best interact with the campus and community. So this is why you've chosen this specific format. So I would just, from the beginning, outline the entire plan and carry that through.
Yeah, I mean, even to get more concrete, this calendar issue could just be part of your institutional profile, like making a reference to this is your structure, and this is how you hope the scholar will interact given the structure of how you're delivering coursework to your students on campus.
No, I think that makes sense, and I guess I would say, if, in fact, with this online course you're developing, if the plan then is to actually engage your scholar in residence as the person who would be teaching that class when your scholar returns home, then talk about that within your proposal as well, because one of the things we're looking at is sustainability. So you're, in fact, thinking through, in this case, even before as the grant begins, the whole notion of sustainability, and that's a plus in your proposal if you can strongly address that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I hope that many of you are familiar with this website. This is the Scholar in Residence webpage. Before we move to the application, just for a reference, we have past webinars that we've done with different college and university institutional types, community colleges, liberal arts institutions, all the way down to rural colleges and universities. So if you do need any more resources in the next week and a half to 2 weeks before you submit your proposal, this is another great resource. You can hear from past institutional hosts and some of their challenges and successes and how they were able to successfully apply to host a scholar in residence. But moving over to the application tab, the MBARC application is right here underneath application for institutions. So I've created a dummy application that we're just going to walk through quickly, maybe not too quickly, so that everyone can see what MBARC looks like, some of the technical issues that have come up with some applicants, just to be able to address that now so that in the future this maybe isn't an issue for your institution if you're applying at 11:30 on October 15th. The first page that comes up is the preliminary question. So the first question is, are you applying on behalf of an American institution of higher education? If the answer is no, if you are a scholar on this call, then you will need the institution to apply for you. So it's an institutionally driven program, and we want to make sure the application is coming from the institutions and not potential scholar in residence themselves. So I've put here my name and my email address. If there are any issues with the application, Tamma Nicholson at IIE would be the person that would be receiving any correspondence from Derek or I. Once you start your application, the next page that you'll see is the application guidelines. The application guidelines are an excellent resource for really everything you need to know about the content of your SIR application. It talks in depth about what is expected in the institutional profile, in the narrative, the different components, everything from the courses that the scholar might be teaching to the enrichment that the scholar would be provided by coming to your campus. So I would recommend in tandem using the guidelines and MBARC to complete your application because they are extremely useful. So once I've read the application guidelines and I have them open on my screen as well, I'll move to the general information page. And this is your institution. This is who you are, where you are, your website, a lot of basic information. And then the question will come up is whether or not this is a joint proposal with another U.S. institution. If yes, all of the information will be duplicated and you just need to fill it out again because we want to make sure that we're communicating with all the stakeholders as we review the applications. So for this instance, I've just selected yes. and then I've come down to the different designations of MSIs, and I've just randomly checked a few, but you can check anything that applies to your institution. If you're unsure, you can also reach out to us at the Scholar in Residence team, and we can look through what the State Department classifies your institutional type as. And then the responsive administrative official. In some institutions, this might be the same person. It might be a secondary person. So I put my name again, that I'm the responsible administrative official for this program. This is not going to be the person that will be, this will be the person that we are communicating with in regards to your application directly. So this will be the person that, if your application is selected or if we have questions about funding or anything between now and the fall semester in 2019, this will be the main person that we're in contact with, not necessarily the Scholar in Residence Supervisor or their faculty associate, but really our main point of contact here at IIE. So I've put this information for myself. You can obviously put whatever applies to your institution. The one question that has come up a little bit is the telephone number. There's a 12 or 14 character limit, so I realize for some institutions you might have a longer extension and it doesn't actually fit. I have recommended that if you do have an extension that you need to add, just put it in the fax line. I promise you that we're not going to fax you, so there's really not a whole lot of use for that line. So I would just use both if you're finding that you can't put your correct contact information. And then for the second institution, you would just put all that same information again. For this, I should have asked David first, I guess, but David, I put you as the second responsible administrative official on this dummy application.
Okay, good.
Put in all the information. So in this instance, both David and I would receive an email, hopefully, that our grant has been funded and that we can move forward because both of our information is filled out on here. So just going to check. I don't see any red. Looks like everything's been submitted accurately. I'm going to go down to the bottom and go to Save and Next. So now we start getting more specific about the program dates of the proposal. For here, I put August 1st, 2019 to December 1st, 2020. This is outside the grant parameters for the SIR program and what Derek mentioned, because this would be over a year proposal. The system won't catch it, but we will. So just make sure that your grant does not start earlier than August 1st, 2019. And does not end later than the spring semester in 2020.
Yeah, there's actually a question sort of related to this that's come in. The question is August 1, 2020 too late for a proposal ending date? Or does the visiting scholar have to finish the on-campus visit by July 30, 2020? And this is actually by the same person who was talking about the semester, the previous question that we had.
I don't think that there would be any restrictions that the scholar would have to finish by July 30th, assuming that they started much later. So I don't think that would be a problem.
Yeah, I think as long as we were looking at the sort of, if it wasn't outside of the bounds of that academic year length or semester length, it probably wouldn't be an issue, but we'll defer to David for a sort of final comment on that.
No, I think that's right. I mean, we would look at this, and if you said that you wanted, depending on your start date, if you're talking about a date that's later than August 1, then we would say, okay, maybe you're starting later, therefore you're ending later. You would still might say to us, we'd still like to do, you know, whether it's a full semester or whether it's a full academic year. On occasion, we've had proposals that have started, you know, even sort of unorthodox, where they might have started, let's say, in January and then went through then to the following August, as long as they verified that they, in fact, had work for the scholar to do over the summer months. So there is some flexibility in terms of sort of how you shape that time period.
Awesome. Great. So then moving down, we get to the principal contact for academic arrangements. And I've put Derek here as the principal contact. At this point, we're really not in contact with the principal contact for academic arrangements. So this could be a different person than the responsible administrative official. If you're not sure who that person is, you can just write your name a second time, especially we understand that fall 2019 is a bit far away, so you might not know exactly who the principal contact would be for the scholar in residence. We'd want that to be addressed in the proposal narrative of who maybe the committee might be or the department, but you can leave this a little bit open if you're unsure. But if you are sure, even better. For the second institution, I've put David again, so we'll pretend that the institution, he is the responsible administrative official and the principal contact for academic arrangements. So then we get down to the financial support. So we've broken this out into two different segments. The first is the salary support that the institution is providing as cost share for the scholar, and the second would be the estimated in-kind support. So we'd like to know not just the figure of in-kind support, but exactly how that is broken down, and maybe if, so here I put $10,000 of estimated in-kind support. We'd like to know that $5,000 is for housing and X amount is for insurance and for conference attendance. So this helps us in a number of different ways. Your application is kind of deconstructed once it's submitted and certain information goes to certain stakeholders, but this is really useful, especially if you are asking a Fulbright Commission or U.S. Embassy to recruit on behalf of your institution, that they're able to talk about the different varying elements of support that your institution is offering that might not be monetary. And the last piece is the total institutional support proposed. Just a quick technical aspect on this, the only thing you can type in is numerical characters. So if you type in a dollar sign or a comma or text, the application will not allow it. So you can see here I've put, number doesn't add up, but I've put 15,000 without any dollar sign or anything like that. If I was to put in a comma, then it would turn red, and the application would not allow me to submit once I get to that final step. So I've also put in the institution's approximate salary ranges. This helps our peer review committee determine what some of the capacity is at the institution, what the typical salary range might be for a professor or an instructor. This is not something that is going to eliminate your institution from eligibility depending on what the salary ranges are, but it helps to give a little bit more context about what the salary typically might be at your institution. And now the meat of the proposal, the scholar who you're actually requesting. So if you are requesting a scholar, yes. If you are not requesting a scholar, no. If you're not requesting a scholar, we need you to select two countries within one geographical region. Again, the application doesn't know if you're selecting from across Europe and Africa, so we're going to be relying on institutions to make sure that they're aware of what the geographical regions are broken down by the State Department, and also that would tie into your proposal of why you want a scholar from a particular area. If you do know that the scholar, who the scholar is that you'd like to request, you can select yes and fill in their information. So our fictional institutions are requesting Ms. Sarah Causer as our outreach and recruitment specialist for the SIR program on our campus. So we put in all of her information, her home address, her home institution, all of this information so that if our proposal is approved and we need concurrence from a Fulbright Commission or U.S. Embassy overseas, they're able to contact her right away and make sure that she's vetted and eligible for the program. We also asked for the citizenship, the country of permanent residence, and the country of birth of the scholar. So here I put in a couple of different options, but really the scholar would be determined by the country that they're currently living in and the country that they have citizenship. So we do have a lot of SIRs who might be living in X country for the last 20 years but were born somewhere else, and we consider them a visiting scholar from the country that they have permanent residence or that they are currently in. So this it's okay if that doesn't match up. In this instance, Albania would be the country that would be sending a visiting scholar and not Afghanistan. And then here, the number of dependents who will probably be accompanying the scholar. You can put as many as you think that the scholar might be bringing with them to your campus. You'll see here it says you've exceeded the maximum length, because again, this has to be a numerical value. It's not an issue. It's not that the scholar had too many by saying two dependents. It's just that you have to type in a number or that won't work. The English proficiency of the scholar we would hope would be excellent. If it is good, then we want to understand why or how the scholar would be able to teach once they came to campus or interact with your campus community. So we hope that English proficiency is excellent, but if it is only good, please elaborate a little bit more in your proposal of why and how the scholar will be able to engage in the community. And then this is helpful if you know that the scholar was previously on campus or previously at an institution, so that we can see how the scholar has interacted with Fulbright in the past. And then lastly, we'd like you to indicate how your institution knows the scholar. So I wrote some various examples that institutions have provided about having an MOU with their home institution or co-presentation at a conference, but we understand there's a multitude of ways that you might be able to interact with the scholar before they come to campus, and we just want to understand how that relationship has been in the past and how this relationship has come about to present them as an SIR on your campus. The other thing you can do is put in two named scholars. If you're unsure that the first scholar is available, you can put in the information of a second scholar. This typically happens when institutions have an MOU with a school overseas, and they're not quite sure if their first scholar would be able to get leave for that semester, or if maybe life events would allow them to travel for a semester or two. So you can put in a second scholar as well. The peer review committee would take this into account, and they would most likely move forward with your A scholar, but it helps us to move seamlessly to your alternate option if the first scholar is not available. So I didn't fill out any of this because I assume that we only have one scholar in mind. And then previous awards that your institution has received through the SIR program. So if you're requesting a scholar that maybe has been to campus before, or the same country that you've hosted before, or the same discipline, we'd want to know why. So this helps us to see, like, okay, there's been scholars from Australia and Zimbabwe in varying disciplines, so we're moving towards campus internationalization in a different discipline or in a different region of the world that maybe the campus doesn't have exposure to. And then the proposal summary, your elevator statement. This is capped at 700 characters, but this is a short summary of your institution, why the SIR program fits, and really what you hope to accomplish by hosting an SIR in the short term and in the long term. It's only 700 characters, so it is a much more truncated version of your SIR application, but this is useful in a quick snapshot to provide to different commissions and embassies and different stakeholders. I know there's a lot of programmatic detail. Were there any questions?
There are a couple of questions on the application so far that are related. One is that, does the application have to be completed in one sitting? And the other is, are we able to begin the application process in Embark and then complete the institutional information first, but then later log on to submit the actual narrative, the institutional profile and the proposal? Yes, you are able to do that. You create an account to log into Embark, and then when you're filling out fields, there's that opportunity to save information as you're going through, and you can always log out, log back in at a later date to actually add those components like the institutional profile, the more narrative portions. That's definitely something you can do, and actually we would encourage you to do that. It's probably better to go on to the online piece first. That way you're familiar with the sort of fields. If you're running into technical issues, you can let us know so that we can sort of work with you through those before the deadline approaches. And then whenever you're ready with your sort of well-honed, crafted proposal, you can go back and upload those closer to the deadline.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would say that anything that's an upload, I would do secondary, but any of this technical details, I would pop that in there, and then at least you know that that's done and out of the way. So we're moving actually on to some of those uploads. The first is the institutional profile essay, which is an average of 4 to 5 pages. We've received a lot of questions recently about the formatting structure of the institutional profile essay and if it's single space or double space or if there's any type of formatting restrictions. And there aren't, as long as you're able to provide sufficient answers to the information needed to identify your institution and why they would be a good fit for the SIR program. I've heard it said as the part where you can kind of sell your institution. So just make sure that the pitch for why your institution is a good fit for the SIR program is encompassed in that 4 to 5 pages. If you're able to do it in less, fantastic. But if you need a little bit more, that's also okay. We just want to make sure that it's focused on some of these outlined points about your institution. So here is, I think, what Derek was mentioning a little bit about some of the uploads. So you don't actually type anything in here. You would work in a Word document or even in a PDF, and then you could simply upload to the platform. So here it's green because it's already been uploaded, and then if I maybe need to make some changes, I can delete this little trash can, or I can upload something, or I'm sorry, I can download and see what has already been submitted. So you don't have to put pictures in your application. This is just a sample PDF I had put in here. This is actually the application guidelines. So if you need to review it, be careful because these buttons are very close together. But you'll see if it's green, it's already been in there. If I delete it, then I'll need to upload a new file for my institutional profile essay. Very similar instructions for the proposed program and the financial support. This is a little bit longer. We ask for 8 to 9 pages for an institution or 12 to 13 for joint proposals. And this is the oversight of the program. This is the academic program of the scholar, the plans, just your whole spiel of what will be accomplished by the SIR coming to campus, and then what will be the sustainable impact on campus afterwards, and who the scholar is, who will be supporting them, and what activities they'll have. So again, you would put this all into one file and upload it. There is a requirement that for each of these areas, only one file can be uploaded. So if you do have a joint proposal, you'd want to combine them into one PDF or one document and then upload all at once.
There was a question that just came in terms of the length of the proposals, and this is kind of related to what Tamman was saying about format, but the question is, are these single or double-spaced pages? And I think that the quick answer is, again, we don't really have any formatting guidelines. Those page lengths are more sort of like what we typically see from proposals that are well thought out, and that includes sufficient information to make a really strong case for hosting the scholar in residence. So I think our recommendation would be, don't focus too much on the length or just trying to hit a specific word count, but focus on really giving us the content that we're asking for, about the ways in which the scholar is going to be engaged on campus, the ways in which hosting someone through this component of Fulbright is going to meet some of those goal statements that you see in the institutional profile, is going to serve your campus community as described in the institutional profile, and then working in those specifics in your academic program and your campus engagement and your community engagement about, you know, why a scholar undertaking this kind of program is going to have the kind of benefits that you're looking for. So focus more on the content rather than on the length. I feel like that's the general guidance that we give.
I would absolutely concur with that. I think the peer review committee is really, they're not so much focused on what the formatting is. They want the details. So whatever way makes the most sense to present them sufficiently in your institution, I would use that as a baseline. Okay, so if you have a request, if you have a named scholar and not a request, there'll be an additional tab here for the scholar CV and letters of recommendation. We ask for 2 letters of recommendation from the scholar and also their CV. We just want to make sure that this matches what you're asking in your proposal or what you're hoping to accomplish. If the scholar doesn't have any teaching background or doesn't have any academic background, that's fine as long as it syncs up with what you're asking the scholar to do. We have scholars who are maybe from a more professional background who are currently participating successfully in the SIR program because they have a background in journalism or in theater or in dance, and it works perfectly with the goals of the institution, but we just want to make sure that's something that's taken into consideration if you're applying for a specific scholar. And those, because of the nature of letters of recommendation and CVs, those will have to be combined into one file just because I'm certain they'll all be coming from different, we hope they're all coming from different sources. And the last, or one of the later aspects for the uploads would be letters of support. And letters of support would be from on-campus officials, maybe even campus student groups, different types of stakeholders, and then also community groups, maybe other institutions in the area, local chapters of certain NGOs or teaching associations or anything that really applies to the scholar's field of expertise. and their acknowledgement of support that they would like to engage with the scholar when they come to campus. This isn't an end-all, be-all list of who can actually interact with the scholar. We do realize that there's a lot of excitement once an SIR comes to campus and starts engaging with certain groups. So you can add to this list, you can detract from this list once the scholar actually comes, but we'd like to see that there's support from the community at large and not just one specific discipline within the institution or even one specific faculty member. This helps us to see that there is a wide range of support supporting this proposal. And the last upload is the responsible administrative official, and this is really the person who signs off on the SIR, the person who can attest to the cost share commitment, the commitment to host the scholar for an academic semester, for two semesters. So this is someone typically with a little bit more of a general university oversight and big picture ability to the institution. And just an upload that they've given the green light and that the SIR, once they come to campus, would be supported by the institution. And the sample syllabi and course outlines also, it's okay if this isn't in full development. It's okay if there's a course that the faculty and the scholar might teach, but you're not actually sure. But we'd like to get a sense of what course components will be included in the SIR proposal. So you can send us kind of an outline of what the scholar could be teaching and how they'll be engaging with students in the classroom. And it could be a variety of courses. There could be maybe three or four that the scholar might be teaching or would be good fits depending on their expertise, but we'd like to see what those would be. All right, and finally, now that I've submitted all of my uploads, I can see if there are any errors before I actually submit and things that won't allow me to submit. So I'm seeing that I have to go back and fix my total institutional support proposed. I need to upload an institutional profile essay, some letters of support, and that's it. And once these are uploaded, I'll have the option to submit my application. Once your application is submitted, and as long as it's submitted by October 15th, that's when we can move it forward to the peer review committee to review and make selections. So if you do have a few components that you'd like to add to your application, I would recommend waiting until closer to the 15th, and then you can submit, and then it's finalized. But I think it is a good idea, like Derek said, to get in the system now and see if there's anything that maybe you're forgetting that isn't on your checklist or any other questions that you might have. I kind of forgot about the syllabi and course outlines that I was going through this, actually. So it's really helpful to see, okay, this is something that needs to be required, and it's better to see that now than to see it on October 15th.
Maybe we could talk just quickly about overall timeline, sort of following application submission and what happens. So the deadline is October 15th. Once you submit your application, that gets moved to the peer review committee. That committee is meeting in early December. Mm-hmm. Once the committee meets, then we start notifying institutions about the outcome of their proposals in early January. So that's when you'd all be hearing back with hopefully the good news that your proposal's been accepted, or you'd hear back with some feedback about, you know, what the results of the review committee were, why your institutional profile may not have been submitted, in the hopes that we could have you try again in the future and have a successful proposal. So that's the sort of overall timeline.
And one question we get often is how many proposals are typically funded in a cycle, and it does vary depending on how many institutions apply. Last year, we had 39 institutions who applied, and 32 were funded for proposals. And one thing that I think is fantastic about the Scholar in Residence program is those institutions that were not funded, significant feedback was given to apply for next year, and we hope that they will be applying next year. So it's not, even if you're unsure about maybe the quality of your proposal, or if you think there maybe could be things that you could expand upon, we can get some validation from the peer review committee. So it's not all for nothing if your application is not funded. So if you're a little bit unsure if you have all the components or if your application is maybe up to snuff, I would still recommend that you apply, and the odds are in your favor. Last year, 32 out of 39, you have very good odds that you will receive funding for an SIR.
There is a question that came in here related to the MBRC application that we've gone through. So the question is this. To be clear, the responsible administrative official in the general information section can be different from the responsible administrative official in the later application section. I think that second one is actually named something slightly different, but you can actually let me know, Tamman, if that's correct.
I think they're actually, I think
they are both responsible administrative officials.
They're both named the same person. That's a really good catch.
Yeah,
maybe something we should fix in the application.
The question here then is that can that be two separate people? Is that acceptable? And then the reason she asked this is she says, for example, I am the center director organizing the application and the activities of the scholar, but then the dean would be the actual official administrative official. So I think, yes, you can certainly indicate, two different individuals. And we would encourage you to indicate on the MBRC application the people who need to hear from us about, the outcome of the proposal. That way we are in touch with the right people on campus so that once that proposal is, we hope, approved, we're in touch with the right people to sort of get things rolling for the scholar's ultimate presence on campus.
Yes, absolutely. We'll have that fixed for next year. Apologies for that.
Yeah.
That confuses.
But it can be, it does seem like there's a need for two separate contacts, then it can be two separate people. It does not need to be the same person.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll give we'll give some more time for questions. We have this set for an hour, and we have about 9 minutes left. If there aren't any questions that come in, we do have perhaps a few more things that we could just highlight for you guys, but I'll give it to Tamman here to run through this, but please type in any questions that you have. We're happy to answer them.
Sure. So one question we've often gotten through this webinar series is what kind of in-kind or monetary contributions are absolutely required to host a scholar-in-residence? And there is no baseline requirement. Financial contributions are evaluated by the capacity to host at the institution. So we realize that this is going to vary greatly depending on institutions and their size and scope. And we encourage institutions that aren't able to provide any type of salary supplement to think creatively about the ways that they could provide some type of in-kind support. And this can range in a variety of ways, whether it's professional development, through conferences and conference attendance, or maybe it's some type of on-campus or off-campus housing. One school, I think, recently added childcare for the young dependents of the SIR they were planning on bringing to campus is something they would include because they have an on-campus facility for the scholars' children. So there's a lot of different unique ways that schools can help to talk more about the cost share. And this is really useful, especially if there isn't a scholar in mind and we're doing a little bit more recruitment, that we can say comprehensively what contributions and what is being offered by the institution. The other question we always seem to get is whether or not the peer review committee looks unfavorably at recruitment requests. And the answer is no. They're looking at your institution and the goals of your institution. There's no preference given to named candidates and named scholars versus recruitment. We've had instances where the school has been approved and the actual named scholar attached to their application, there has been some concerns that maybe they don't fit and we should actually move this to a recruitment type of SIR. So there's no specific restrictions about, or no specific guidance that if you're a named scholar, you're going to have a better opportunity to have your proposal funded than if it's a scholar for recruitment.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point to highlight as well, is that, in the case of a proposal that names a specific scholar, the review committee actually looks at the proposal and the scholar separately to approve both. So it can be the case, as Tamman just mentioned, that a proposal from an institution is approved, but the named scholar is not approved.
One thing that I would add, though, is if you are requesting scholar recruitment, I would think carefully about what two countries and why they fit, and try and keep maybe two countries in scope, and not just say I'm seeking, or our institution is seeking a scholar from somewhere in Asia or somewhere in sub-Saharan Africa, and maybe from countries that are thousands of miles apart. What is the link between those countries, if there is one, and why is that the focus of your institution? So I would try and keep it narrow to those two countries if you are requesting scholar recruitment.
There is a question on this topic that came up related to recruitment of scholars. So if we do not name a scholar, is there a significant risk that an appropriate scholar would not be found? Are there sufficient applicants?
It depends on the country that you're seeking a scholar from. We ask for a little bit more flexibility if you're, or we like that institutions can be a little bit more flexible if they are seeking scholar recruitment. And we will try and guide institutions towards appropriate countries for recruitment because some are stronger than others. And from our knowledge at IAE and from the State Department, we're aware of what countries might have a larger scholar pool. But there is the possibility that there might not be a scholar that is available that year, and we might need to defer to another year or to another semester. The institution still keeps the grant. So your grant is still for your institution if we're not able to successfully recruit for a scholar for that academic year. But once your grant is approved in January or December, we immediately notify the commissions and the U.S. embassies, and we give mid-April to early May as a deadline to have a few different applications for review for your institution, and then ultimately those applications and those CVs are sent to your committee in your institution to review and select your number one candidate for your SIR grant, and then throughout the summer we're working on getting their documents collected so they can come to campus. So we have a pretty tight timeline. There is situations every year where maybe one school, the scholar is not able to be identified, or even named scholars sometimes have to back out, and they'd like to defer for a second year, for another year, or we have to move to a scholar recruitment request. So we understand that life happens and that we're planning very far in advance, and really a lot of things can change between October 15th and the start of the
year. Yeah, what I would recommend if you're asking for recruitment, it may not be a bad idea to let us know which countries you're considering in advance, because then that can also let us give you some feedback about historical success with those countries conducting recruitment. I mean, not that we want to guide you away from any specific countries. We want you to pick what makes the most sense for your proposal, but we can give you a little bit of that insight that we have in our experience working on the program.
Another question we have is whether institutions can host more than one scholar, or whether they can apply to host more than one scholar. And the answer is yes, but only one scholar would be funded at a time. So if you submit multiple applications for your institution, the committee would go with whichever application they ranked higher.
And there aren't any more questions that have come through yet. David, is there anything you feel like we should add before we close out the webinar?
Just a couple points of guidance. For the schools that are thinking about asking for recruitment, we typically ask that you indicate two different countries, and there's a method behind that madness. It's because if in case we couldn't actually recruit from a given country, there's a second country that you've asked for, there'd be a good chance of still getting you a scholar from one country, if not the other. The point about that is, though, when you're talking about your needs, think how you've crafted your language so that, for example, if you said, I'd like a scholar from Japan or Korea, make sure that your proposal addresses both Japan and Korea, not one versus the other, so that we're able to actually recruit for you from both countries based on the guidance you've given us in terms of what your needs are within your proposal.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And we've seen some examples in the draft proposals of universities that are asking, or institutions that are asking for, you know, scholar recruitment from two countries that have done very good jobs of doing that, of, you know, indicating maybe a preference even for one country. But if a scholar couldn't be recruited from that country, how a scholar from another country would meet needs in a slightly different way and still contribute to meeting a lot of the goals in the proposal. So there are ways to do that in the proposal, but I think that's a great point in that, you know, one of the reasons we want that flexibility in terms of naming more than one country is so that we can maximize our chances of getting you a scholar that meets your needs and feeds into your programming.
That's right. I think we also understand that in cases where you're asking for recruitment, your proposal will be necessarily, I think, a little more open-ended
because you don't know specifically the scholar that you're talking about. You know, you can't necessarily say we'd like to present teach this specific class because you don't know that we can recruit someone for you with that much specificity. So your proposal would likely then be a little more general to say we'd like a scholar to come and teach, you know, with some choices available, which then gives the Fulbright Commission or the U.S. Embassy a bit more latitude as they go and try to recruit a scholar who can meet your needs.
Absolutely. Yeah, so there aren't any more questions that have come in, so maybe we can close it out. Obviously, if there are any questions that come up after the webinar that you wish you had asked, please get in touch with us. We're happy to get back to you. We know time will be short as you work to meet the deadline, but we're happy to have some further dialogue with you to help you strengthen those proposals and strengthen the applications for the review committee that'll meet in December.
And on the screen, you have the SIR inbox, which Derek, myself, and Sarah Causer all have access to. So if your question, regardless of how it relates to SIR, one of the three of us will be able to answer and give you some guidance in the next 2 weeks. And David's information is also on there as well. So if you'd like to go to the person with 35 years of knowledge, he's willing to share his contact information and help your institution out if you do have any questions. Thank you, everyone, for attending. And we look forward to seeing all of your wonderful applications on October 15th.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks very much.